Governor Steve Bullock reaches out to lawmakers to uphold his vetoes. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
In our feature interview this evening, reporter Edward O'Brien follows up with the CEO of the Montana Food Bank Network and talks about why summer may be a time of difficulty for many families. Governor Steve Bullock's office is reaching out to Democratic lawmakers to uphold his vetoes on some key bills from the 2013 legislature. These include some bills that were initially supported by almost the entire legislative body. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the governor is influencing some Democrats, but not all.
In the coming days, lawmakers will be mailing in their votes on 24 of Governor Bullock's 71 vetoes. These 24 bills received a two-thirds vote of both legislative chambers when they passed, so they're eligible for a veto override. If the bills receive that two-thirds vote again, the veto is defeated. But Harlem Democratic Representative Clarina Brockey says she is voting to uphold all of Bullock's vetoes, even though it means changing her mind on some of the measures.
Because I didn't want to undermine him as a Democratic governor. I think he's a good man. I think he's trying to do good for our state.
Brockey says Bullock's office did contact her to talk about the veto overrides, though she says she had already come to her conclusion. Bullock says he has been in contact with both Democrats and Republicans regarding the vetoes. He hopes none of them get overridden.
The legislature looks at sort of bill by bill and then ends up leaving town. When we pull it all together and actually look at here's the overall spend, I think that gives Democrats and Republicans hopefully a little bit of pause to say we don't want to be one of those states that are running record deficits.
The governor maintains he issued many of his vetoes for fiscal reasons, such as making sure the state doesn't spend more money than it takes in over the next 2 years. Bullock also cut spending bills to leave at least $300 million in the state's bank account for the next legislative session. He said throughout the 2013 legislature he wanted to have this $300 million balance, but it wasn't required. In fact, state law only requires a little more than $40 million be left in the bank. Still, Bullock faults legislators for leaving about 200 bills on his desk when they left. He says if he would have had more time with some of these bills, he may have been able to work with lawmakers to fit them in his budget. Missoula Democratic Senator Dave Wansenried says he voted on the veto overrides as soon as he received them in the mail. The longtime legislator says, for the most part, he voted the same way on them this time around as he did during the session.
The governor doesn't vote for me and I don't work for him. I work for the people that vote for me in Missoula.
Wansenried says he agrees with Bullock on most of the vetoes anyway.
If I have a criticism of the administration, it's not that they're trying to affect the votes now. I think that makes sense. If I have a criticism, it's that they didn't try to affect the votes during the session enough.
He uses House Bill 12 as an example. It's a bill the legislature, including Wansenried, strongly supported, which Bullock vetoed. The bill increases rates the state pays to providers of Medicaid services.
I came through two committees that I was on, and nobody from the administration testified either time. And we never got lobbied about it not being affordable.
Wansenried says former Governor Brian Schweitzer's administration took a different approach on securing vetoes. He says when Schweitzer planned on vetoing a bill, he tried to make sure the legislation initially had as many no votes as possible.
So that he was confident if he vetoed the bill that it would be upheld.
That is not the case this time around. At least a half dozen of Bullock's vetoes had the support of more than 90% of lawmakers. So it's unclear if the governor's influence will be enough to uphold the vetoes. The results will be released over the next 2 weeks. The last time Montana lawmakers successfully defeated a governor's veto was in 1999. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, a state senator and Blackfeet leader who fled a traffic stop was right when he told a Glacier County sheriff's deputy the officer had no jurisdiction to arrest him. Glacier County Attorney Carolyn Berkram said today, county law enforcement officers have no jurisdiction over enrolled tribal members or descendants within the exterior boundaries of the Blackfeet Indian Reservation. Burkram declined to discuss specifics in the case of Blackfeet Tribal Councilman and State Senator Shannon Ogier. Ogier was pulled over by a deputy Sunday night on the reservation 9 miles west of Cutbank. Sheriff's officials say Ogier appeared impaired and a smell of alcohol was coming from the vehicle. Ogier allegedly told the deputy he had no jurisdiction to arrest him and fled as the deputy attempted to take his keys.
A Montana couple is appealing a judge's dismissal of their lawsuit against Remington Arms Company. U.S. District Judge Richard Siebel ruled in April time had run out on the claim of a 1989 shooting that left Brad Humphrey paralyzed was caused by a defect in the Remington Model 700 rifle. The 2012 lawsuit claims the rifle misfired when Humphrey's stepson slipped entering a truck while hunting in Cascade County. Humphrey and his wife, Diana, said they only found out the problems with the Remington 700 after watching a CNBC documentary in 2010. Siebel ruled that didn't matter. The judge said Humphrey had 3 years to investigate a potential claim from the time of his injury. The Humphreys filed the notice Tuesday. They are appealing to the 9th U.S. District Court of Appeals.
To encourage Montanans to buckle up, the Missoula Police Department joined the 2013 National Click It or Ticket Seatbelt Enforcement Mobilization. This means that there have been more patrols on the road since May 20th. Public Information and Communications Director Ginny Merriam says the Missoula Police Department's central mission is public safety.
Here's an opportunity for the police department to be able to get a little bit of extra funding through the state to enforce seatbelt laws, which have been demonstrated to keep people safe.
Preliminary numbers indicate that 78% of people who died in crashes in Montana were not wearing a seatbelt, a 32% increase from last year. The extra patrols will end on June 2nd, but officers enforce seatbelt laws year-round. For more information, visit buckleup.mt.gov.
An Australian company seeking to take control of a Montana coal mine and boost exports to Asia is in discussions with state officials about a potential $10 million loan from an economic development trust. Both sides said today the talks are in preliminary stages and the amount of any loan could change. It would be paired with money from a private bank and used to buy and refurbish mining equipment. The possibility of state assistance for Amber Energy comes after the company's bid to take over the Decker coal mine near the Wyoming border was delayed in early May for unspecified reasons. Amber-related efforts to build ports in Oregon and Washington and ship coal to Asia faces opposition from environmentalists and some West Coast elected officials.
Researchers say homes within walking distance of shops and restaurants will drive the housing markets in mountain communities for the interior West as the economy continues to recover. The Sanaran Institute, a nonprofit that calls for better management of growth in the West, studied high country housing trends from 2000 to 2010. The study found home buyers are willing to pay an average of 18.5% more for a house in a walkable mountain neighborhood in the Rocky Mountains. But the supply of homes in or near downtown commercial areas is too small. Clark Anderson, director of the Institute's Western Colorado program, tells the Denver Post, quote, "It's an untapped market opportunity," end quote. The study focused on six communities, including Carbondale, Eagle and Buena Vista, as well as Bozeman, Montana, Teton Valley, Idaho, and Boise, Idaho.
A misdemeanor charge of partner or family member assaulted filed against a deputy Flathead County attorney has been dismissed. Thane Johnson is the attorney for Kenneth Rusty Park. He tells the Daily Interlake the dismissal document says the state didn't believe it could prove the case in court. The charge was filed against Park after his estranged wife reported he threw a laundry basket containing several items at her, causing bruising. Park was arrested late on April 26. Johnson was able to get Justice of the Peace Mark Sullivan to hold a midnight hearing so Park could be released on bond early the next day, rather than spending the next weekend in jail. The state looked over the prosecution of the case and decided not to pursue it. Park declined to comment.
Police in Billings are investigating several sexual assaults against college-age women dating back to January. Montana State University Billings issued an advisory to its students on Wednesday. MSUB Police Chief Scott Forche says because the victims were college-age, the school decided to inform the students to take safety precautions. None of the assaults occurred on campus. Billings Police Chief Rich St. John says it's not clear if the assaults are related, but there are some similarities in the cases. He did not say how many assaults had been reported. The advisory described the suspect as a white man who is 5 feet, 5 inches tall, 25 to 30 years old with a thin build and light colored hair.
The Montana Department of Corrections has selected four finalists for the position of warden at the Montana Women's Prison in Billings. Corrections spokesman Bob Inez tells the Billings Gazette that the agency received 46 applications. Warden Jo Acton announced her retirement in March, shortly after a department investigation of an employee's complaint found she was emotionally unstable, led by fear and intimidation, and lacked professionalism in running the prison. The finalists include Deputy Warden for Treatment Services, John Daly, and Deputy Warden for Security and Maintenance, Bob Paul. The out-of-state finalists are Claire Armstrong Seward, who has worked in various positions in the New York Department of Correctional Services, and James Gerlach, administrator of the Montrose County Sheriff's Office in Colorado. The agency expects to name a replacement by July 1st.
A woman charged in a drunken driving crash near East Helena that killed a grandmother and her granddaughter has denied five charges in the case. The Independent Record reports 21-year-old Ariel Michelle Shesky pleaded not guilty yesterday to two counts of vehicular homicide while under the influence, one count of felony negligent vehicular assault, one count of misdemeanor assault, and driving with a suspended or revoked license. Prosecutors say Shesky was driving on the wrong side of the road on April 30th when her car struck another vehicle head-on, killing 51-year-old Mildred Catherine Richard and her 16-year-old granddaughter, Justine Catherine Smith. District Judge Kathy Seeley set a July 29th trial date. Shesky remains jailed on $100,000 bail.
Summer is almost here for many Americans. That's the time to think about spending a few well-earned days away from work and getting away for an adventure. For many, though, it's also a time of increased anxiety and stress because it can sometimes be a little more difficult to find that next meal. In tonight's feature interview, Edward O'Brien speaks with Gail Gifford, CEO of Montana Food Bank Network. The agency serves almost 200 member organizations with emergency food services. Gifford is a relatively new addition to the Missoula organization, but she's quite well-versed in the field.
I was with the Great Falls Community Food Bank for 6 years prior to this, and we were a redistribution organization for MFBN.
What does that mean, redistribution?
We kind of helped to assist them get out into greater areas. We were also a distribution center. We did not do direct service and do emergency food boxes, but we had agencies of our own that we served, very similar to what MFBN does, just on a Cascade County level.
How did you get into this field to begin with?
You know, actually, I was with a direct service provider for many years. I've been in the nonprofit sector for about 20, and most of that is being in direct service. I worked with a domestic violence shelter and got very interested in the efforts that were going on as far as assisting people that were in poverty with food needs, and really what a foundation that is for any future success. I mean, you can't be good in school, you can't be good in your job if you're hungry. So when I came to the food bank in Great Falls, it began to really come to me as being a really critical part. I mean, salary is one thing, but you can't go out and get a successful job unless you're full.
How do you at the Montana Food Bank Network, and maybe this is a weird question, define hunger?
Well, there's different levels of it. There's something called food insecurity, and that is basically not knowing where your next meal is going to be coming from on a regular basis. And we do have about 1 in 7 adults here in Montana are considered to be food insecure. Then there's also just the infrequency, and maybe there's food in their household, but they might not be eating regularly. And then there's those individuals who are just from month to month maybe struggling a few days out of the month. They might be getting support from disability or from unemployment, but the check doesn't go far enough, and there's maybe 3 or 4 days out of the month that they're needing help.
So does this all go back to poverty?
It really does. You know, and I guess I'm just a big advocate of the whole foundation of it. It is going to be making sure that we have employable wages here in Montana. Most individuals, or all individuals that are receiving emergency food assistance or SNAP or summer food program, their kids are participating in that, all are not making a livable wage. And so when you figure 1 out of 7 Montanans on the severe side of the food insecurity are not making a livable wage to be able to provide for themselves and their families. Very, very basic.
Livable wage is always kind of a bit of a controversial topic in some circles, and certainly in a state like Montana, where you're not going to get rich in many cases living here, yeah?
Right, and really a livable wage is defined as over $10 an hour. So you figure anybody who is working even 1 or 2 minimum wage jobs are not going to be able to provide adequately for their families. And then we have to look, we're a very retail service oriented state as far as employment is concerned, and even within agriculture, if you're not the ranch owner, you're not making full minimal wages. So we're seasonal. There's just a lot of issues that go on here in Montana that make it very challenging for people to be able to make an affordable wage.
There are a lot of people who don't believe hunger is a serious problem in America. There's always something we can eat.
Not necessarily so. One of the things that we suffer here in Montana, and you'll see in a lot of other bordering states and other states that are very rural, is we have something called food deserts. And we may be a very food-rich country, but if you live in a very rural community and your closest grocery store is 80 miles away, and you've got a car with 200,000 miles on it, and you have a tough time even, you know, getting that to start on a day-to-day basis, it's really very challenging for them. Then they go to those grocery stores that are so far away, and it's incredibly expensive. It might just be the one grocery store in a very rural area, and so their food is pretty expensive and not within their affordability.
Then, how do you explain obesity in America?
You know, that's a feast or famine type of a thing, to put it in simplicity. You will find that people in poverty, when they do have money, they do have food, they basically just really enjoy it. And that's what happens when you get into the obesity cycle in poverty. You get maybe 3 or 4 days out of the month, they have their checks come in, possibly they have their SNAP access, or they get an emergency food box. They eat really well for a few days, and then there's nothing for a few days. And so it's that real feast or famine that just messes up your metabolism. It becomes a trend for them. And they don't always make the good choices either. I mean, it's a matter of just making sure that you have food in your pantry, not necessarily nutritious food.
So junk food, chips, whatever, pizza.
Which sometimes that's the most affordable thing, too. Hmm. You know, you can go get a $5 pizza, but good luck trying to get a decent salad for that somewhere. Yeah.
So then how well are organizations like the Montana Food Bank Network and the pantries you work with keeping up with this need in Montana?
You know, we've saw some increase in the last few years, obviously, when the economy kind of went down a little bit. And so that was a real struggle for a lot of families. But I think it's always been an issue here because we do have distribution problems. We do have food deserts here. We do have low wages in our state. And that has not changed. So that's always going to be a consistent issue. What we are starting to see now versus, say, 4 or 5 years ago is people who were maybe living on the edge but still surviving on their own are not making it anymore. The unemployment rates might be really attractive right now, but that's individuals who are working 2 or 3 jobs to keep their head above water. They're employed, but they're not employed high enough. Or they have just dropped off the unemployment rolls, which is a whole other controversy that we talk about. But it's not necessarily that we're improving as an economy here in our state, but I think people are just learning to adapt better to it. And maybe they're eating 2 meals instead of 3, or they're getting some more assistance for their children, or they're going without themselves as an adult to make sure that their kids eat.
And that applies Great Falls, Missoula, no matter where you are.
Throughout the state, we have a hunger relief or hunger study that the Montana Food Bank does every other year. And we ask families about how often do you give up a meal in order for your children to eat. And it's more frequently than we'd like to believe. I think at least a third of the families say that they give up on a regular basis meals so that their child can eat.
That's so foreign to me. I'm very fortunate. When I get hungry, I have no question about I'm going to get breakfast, lunch, snacks, dinner. It's just a very foreign concept to me and maybe many other people.
And it is, you know, to think that you have to open the cupboard and there'll be nothing there. I mean, we're pretty fortunate. We go home and you stand there in the front of your refrigerator and you try to decide what looks good for dinner. And you take a family in poverty who are living in a food insecure situation, you open up that refrigerator and you might have a couple condiments and, you know, that kind of thing. And that's about it. There isn't much else in there. I've heard a story of a woman who told me one time that they had a jar of this prickly pear jam that somebody had given them in a food basket one time, and the kids all got all grossed out about it, but she stuck it in the cupboard, and that became their barometer. They knew when the only thing that they had left was that prickly pear jam in their cupboard, they were in dire straits. So that was kind of the security level that the kids had. As long as, even if there was a box of macaroni and cheese sitting next to it, they knew they were okay. But if there was nothing next to it, then they knew they were in trouble.
It's kind of depressing.
It really very much is, and I think you hear that story more and more often than we would care to.
Okay. Gail, we're standing here in the Montana Food Bank Network warehouse. We're looking at all sorts of canned foods at the moment. What are we looking at in terms of supply? How well set up are you right now?
Well, one of the things that we hope within our distribution warehouse is that we don't have a lot sitting in our warehouse, because to us, the idea of getting it out there is getting it out there quickly and frequently. So you see that we don't have a lot in our warehouse, but that isn't because necessarily we don't have it available to us right now. It means we're trying to get it out into the community. Now, is it enough? No. We distribute a little over 7 million pounds a year, but we also serve 160 76 agencies, and they're doing high levels of distribution as well. So when you look at the distribution on that, it's not much per pantry that we're getting out there, and we would love to be able to increase that.
Increase how?
Through food donations, food drives, if you can even assist us or if you can assist one of the partner agencies, that is definitely a benefit for all of us to make donations. And if they want to make a reoccurring donation or a one-time donation, they have an access through our website at mfbn.org. We do have an online donation button there. We also love to have volunteers. So if you've got a group that wants to come down, we always need help in the warehouse. We've got a repackage room that we take bulk product and break it down into consumer size. We're looking for help that way. So there's many, many different ways that you can help out, not only the Montana Food Bank Network, but all of our partner agencies.
How far is a dollar getting you these days?
Well, we have taken a look at that just recently because, of course, the cost of living is going up and food prices and fuel prices and so on. And we are right now, for every dollar that you donate, it provides 6 meals. Last year, it was 7 meals. And it's going, it's changing a little bit because of the cost of all of the transportation issues and food issues. We have a number of different resources that we get our food from. We work with Feeding America, and we're a part of that network. We also get a lot of food donated. We have something called the Grocery Rescue Program, where we go around to all the major retailers and pick up their product that has either had its Best Buy sell-by date or is just an item that they cannot get. And then we also have a food purchasing program as well. So that's where a lot of the donated dollars go to, is in transportation and purchasing those items that we don't have access to in any other way.
When a lot of people think about volunteering, donating, they think maybe Thanksgiving, Christmas, that's got to be the toughest time. And here we are heading into summertime. A lot of us focused on our vacations, our plans. So maybe, I don't know, is it tough this time of year or not?
It is, because that's when I think just traditionally donors aren't necessarily having donations first and foremost in their mind. During the holidays is a real charitable mindset for a lot of individuals, but during the summer is not. But when you think about all of the children particularly that are benefiting from free and reduced lunch programs, they might be participating in the backpack program that MFBN sponsors at a number of schools. They have access through their school network. But when school is out, all of that goes away. So now the families that are having to spend additional monies in order to provide for their kids 3 meals instead of just 1 meal a day, and that's a real strain on a family when your budget doesn't change at all through the summer months, and in some cases it really does get reduced.
Okay, so again, mfbn.org.
Right, and that's a good place to be able to look at what type of distribution we do, the agencies we serve, make a donation. There's all kinds of access information on that. Remember that it's not hunger to last all year long. It's not just during Christmas, Thanksgiving. It is all year long, and we want to make sure that the families in need out there are taken into consideration all the time. So when you sit down and you have that barbecue with your family this summer, remember that there's a family out there that is struggling just to put even cereal in the bowl, let alone a steak.
Gail Gifford, CEO, Montana Food Bank Network, thanks a lot for your time and for the work you do as well.
Oh, thank you very much, and we look forward to working with anybody that would love to give us a call.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain showers. Lows will be in the 30s. Tomorrow expect more cloudy skies. Highs will be in the upper 60s to mid-70s. Sunday will also be cloudy with a chance of scattered storms. Lows will be in the upper 30s to mid-40s, and highs will be between 60 to 70 degrees. For central Montana, tonight calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain. Lows will range between 35 to 45 degrees. Tomorrow expect more cloudy skies, and highs will peak around 60 to 70 degrees. Sunday calls for more cloudy skies with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. And for southwest Montana, tonight calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain. Lows will stick around 30 to 40 degrees. Tomorrow expect more cloudy skies with highs peaking around 60 to 70 degrees. Sunday calls for partly cloudy skies with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will be around 35 to 40 degrees with highs around 60 to 70 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Roberts.
A recent article in the May 2nd issue of the New England Journal of Medicine reports on a study of a group of adults in Oregon who were given the option of applying for Medicaid health insurance in 2008. This study is important because it shows what happens when uninsured people do get health insurance, in this case, Medicaid. Our own state legislature recently decided in a very close vote not to accept federal funds to expand Medicaid in Montana. Despite this, or maybe because of it, we all need to understand some of the important facts about health, health care, and health insurance. The Oregon experiment clearly shows that providing Medicaid health insurance to a group of uninsured, poor adults does improve access to health care. It also improves self-assessment of healthiness, the diagnosis, treatment, and symptoms of depression, the diagnosis and treatment of diabetes, cholesterol screening, and frequency of pap tests and mammograms. People were more likely to have a regular doctor and access to what they felt was high-quality, comprehensive care. Also, and as expected, Medicaid insurance leads to a significantly lower rate of medical debt and catastrophic spending on medical care. Poor people are sicker than rich people, whether or not they have insurance. But having insurance and therefore improved access to health care for just 2 years, as in this study, doesn't mean that many aspects of health will be measurably improved for any group of people, rich or poor. What it does mean is that if you get sick, you can get the kind of care you need sooner rather than later, and you won't go broke because of your illness. You're more likely to get needed preventive care, to feel healthier and less depressed, and to get any chronic illness treated. But health is much more than health care. Our health in the U.S. is significantly and measurably worse than every other developed country in the world. We live shorter lives and suffer more disability. This is true even for educated, high-income people in the U.S. compared to their peers in other countries. There are multiple reasons for this, including our fragmented and specially oriented medical system and our very high rates of under- and uninsured. But our poor health is also due to many factors that are not directly related to actual health care. The U.S. has more segregation, violence, drug and alcohol abuse, lung disease, heart disease, AIDS, infant mortality, teenage sex, stress, and poverty. We exercise less, have a poor diet, and have more environmental health barriers than other developed countries. We also have very different attitudes about the role of government in helping to create a healthy society. Because of the Affordable Care Act starting this coming October, anybody in Montana earning more than about $11,000 a year will be able to purchase affordable health insurance. Coverage will start on January 1 of 2014. This insurance will be available without regard to age or prior illness. It will be comprehensive. Different insurance options will be easily comparable. In Montana, it looks like three insurance companies will be competing in this health insurance marketplace called an exchange. It will be accessible over the internet. Insurance brokers and others will be trained to help people, but individuals can do it themselves. Each person or family will be able to choose the insurance plan they want to purchase. Costs will vary depending on income and which plan is chosen. For those who are not earning very much, the cost will be subsidized and affordable. For many people and some small businesses who are now buying their own insurance, it will make financial sense to purchase through the exchange because of these subsidies. For those who are newly insured, we can expect improved access to timely and comprehensive health care along with less financial stress. This may well be true for people who are currently insured, but with expensive and less comprehensive policies. But we should keep in mind that having insurance will not improve many of the factors that lead to poor health in the U.S. Unfortunately, we have missed a rare opportunity to provide Medicaid or any insurance to those who are less well off in our state. As a result, these needy people will continue with worse health care and worse financial, physical, and mental health. The advantages of having health insurance, including Medicaid, are very clear. To think otherwise makes no sense. We need to understand that what we do collectively regarding all aspects of health determines how well we live. This failure by our legislature to expand Medicaid has not been a positive step towards good health in Montana. Thanks for listening. This is Dr. Tom Roberts.
Tom Roberts is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetic. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.